You're him. You're Caesar.
I did not start this war, but I will finish it.
You are impressive, but you're taking this much too personally.
So emotional!
Apes together.
We're still doing claps. That still helps you.
I mean, I think it helps you.
It makes me feel good. I like clapping. I'm like a monkey. I like clapping.
Don't say monkey. The apes don't like that.
That's true. That's a good point.
Oh, hello everyone, and welcome back once again to Podcast Part 3, the Part 3 Podcast, your go-to source for all things about movies that came after two other movies. As always, I am Sam.
And I am Will.
And welcome to the end of what I'm going to assume is a sort of marathon drop of episodes that I've been behind on editing. I hope you enjoyed Death Wish 3 and Back to the Future Part 3, because now it's time to get serious. Because it's time for War of the Planet of the Apes from 2017. The 9th movie in the Planet of the Apes long-running saga, and the conclusion of the reboot trilogy that started with Rise of the Planet of the Apes. And as we said with Escape from the Planet of the Apes, this is like the most consistently good franchise in movie history, and that's just ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, especially considering how iconic that first movie is and how much it's been parodied and lampooned. You would just expect the sequels to just ride that movie's coattails and just kind of do the same thing over and over again.
Well, I mean, there was a reboot that did that.
Well, but they only did that one time. It wasn't like every time out of, you know, 9-10 movies now.
Well, so. I think a big part of it is that somewhere along the way they figured out how to make them look like apes.
Well, that too, yeah.
You know. So when we last left the Planet of the Apes franchise, we'd been with Cornelius and Zira in swinging 70s Los Angeles, where they were brutally gunned down along with their infant child. And so that franchise, the original franchise, had two more installments, Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, which is great, and Battle for the Planet of the Apes, which had no money. And
and it shows.
It shows. And then the franchise kind of existed in other forms for like basically like 20 years or so, 15, 20 years.
There was a TV show and an animated series.
Yeah, a lot of novelizations and comics.
Comic books,
I remember Star Trek meets Planet of the Apes happened at one point. Because if it's not a Twilight Zone episode, Planet of the Apes is a planet that Kirk would have 100% arrived on in
the original series. Yeah,
And Nova would have been like, what is Kiss?
What is love?
It's really, it's 100%. If you swap out Charlton Heston for Shatner and just cut the budget by 75%, it's a Star Trek episode.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then there was finally a remake, reboot, what call it what you will, of the original in, I believe, 2001, directed by Tim Burton, best known for Dark Shadows and Dumbo.
Yes, and it is, it's starring, did you say who it was starring?
It's starring,
Mark Wahlberg.
Mark Wahlberg, Kris Kristofferson, and Estella Warren, so a country singer and two underwear models in the human roles, and then Tim Roth, and Michael Clark Duncan, and Helena Bonham Carter, and Paul Giamatti.
Paul Giamatti.
There's the only reason to see the movie now is for the ape makeup, which is it's Rick Baker at his best. It's really good, and Paul Giamatti is just crushing it.
Yeah.
He's
so
good.
He is having the time of his life.
Yeah.
I mean, the production design is cool and everything, but it is everything you expect of a early 2000s studio product.
Yeah. I don't know what they were going for, honestly, because it's a movie. It's one of those movies that thinks it's a little too cool for school. Like it thinks it's cooler than the original Planet of the Apes. And it's like, we're different. We're doing our own thing. We're telling our own version, but we're also going to reference it in every way, shape, and form.
Right. Exactly. It's very weird. And then the thing that I think that really kills it is they try to do the twist from the original movie, but sort of backwards.
Well,
and
in a way that doesn't make any sense.
And right, and that's the thing.
It doesn't, and there's no, like, it, like if you watch the original Planet of the Apes, the very ending is basically this pulls the rug out from under Charlton Heston's character arc, right, where he starts out as this misanthrope that hates humanity and becomes its greatest defender and then realizes he was right the first time.
Right.
There's Mark Wahlberg doesn't have an arc, and he's not a very interesting character. I don't even remember if it was a big hit or not. It was just
kind of... I think it came and went. It was kind of in the middle of like a weird summer. The summer of 2001 was an odd summer.
Well, summer of 2001 was in many ways the last scream of the 90s. So, yes. It's not a movie... It's not the worst movie I've ever seen, but it's not one I revisit very often, even as an Apes fan.
Yeah, it's just, it's like a lot of sort of late period Tim Burton movies. It's production design in search of a story, you know? It can't sort of figure out what it's doing.
And it's also like a lot of, I would say, 2000s era remakes where you're not really sure why they're doing it beyond name recognition. Remaking old shit, especially horror movies, but lots of stuff like The Manchurian Candidate or stuff like that. You know, it was just kind of like a, you know, or the Psycho remake. It's like, like, what are you doing? Why are you doing it? And it's like, and I guess with Apes, with the case of Tim Burton's and with the new ones, the big answer is we can make it and have it look better than the original, which is yes, but that's missing the point. The original Apes movies work. The makeup of at the time was really advanced and is, you know, it still holds up. It still works, but it's, you know, it's campy. It's not, there's a suspension of disbelief there. So we rolled around to 2011 and it was time to bring out a new Apes franchise. And it was, I remember the original title was Genesis: Apes.
Oh God, that's right.
Remember that? Yeah. This is one of those times. I think you and I thought this was going to be the stupidest thing we've ever heard about.
Yes. I remember because we went to see this see Rise together. We were kind of like, this is going to be so bad.
Yeah.
I can't, like, why are they doing this?
And it's like,
but the reviews were good. So we were
Everything about it's like James Franco as the lead felt weird. It was not a director I was super familiar with. The first one's Rupert Wyatt. And it's, the only thing it had going for it was Andy Serkis was going to play Caesar. But at the same time, you were kind of like, I think at the time it was kind of like, is this the only guy? Is he like, you know, the only guy we know to play an ape in movies now? And I think it also, the marketing made it seem like it was like a man must pay for his misdeeds type of kind of hacky sci-fi movie.
Right.
But it comes out and you and I were just blown away by how well done it was. It's not a perfect movie by any means. I think all three movies have serious issues with their human characters.
Yeah.
But the realization of Caesar and the other apes in terms of acting and visual effects was absolutely magnificent.
Yeah, and it's one of the few sort of reboot prequel things that like deploys fan service in a really like satisfying way.
Yeah, it was, it used a really light touch.
Well, yeah, and it like, but it references the original movies, but just in like in fun ways that don't take you out of the movie, but also like they acknowledge that they're part of this like saga, you know? So it was kind of cool. In that sense.
And I think it was one of those things where they were kind of like, okay, we can lay these threads to see if there's something we want to come back to later in the franchise. And to their credit, they actually never did because they got confident enough to make this just the story of the apes.
Yeah.
You know, no astronaut coming back. No, you know, no, well, I haven't seen the new one, but no mutants living in the subway worshiping the atomic bomb, anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it no, and you know, in the if you pay attention to that movie, there's the background of Rise of the Planet of the Apes, there is like they talk about the you know, the spaceship going up and all of that, and it, so if they wanted to, they could tug on that thread. There's hints of it in the new one. I don't want to spoil it, but they tease it very little. It's a very little tease, but they tease it a bit.
Oh, sure. Well, yeah, you got it. I mean, it's like the only movie that made money this year, so credit where credit's due.
Yeah, it and Bad Boys. Yep. It, Bad Boys, and like Godzilla and Kong.
Yeah.
Audiences want their apes,
I guess. They want big apes, and they want big friendships in Miami. Oh, how pissed is Vin Diesel that they took Ride or Die from the Fast franchise for that title? He's like,
it's like, that's mine.
You're not part of my family. That being said, a Bad Boys Fast crossover would work like a charm.
I mean, I'm shocked no one has tried it, but I guess it's Universal and Sony would have to play nice. And maybe
Vin Diesel and Will Smith would have to play nice. With The Rock and Jason Statham in there to instigate. Oh, it would be great.
Yeah, the movie would probably be pretty bad, but the making of documentary would be amazing.
Yeah, no, it would make for a great oral history someday. So yeah, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, it's, you know, very different from every other Planet of the Apes movie. It's, you know, it's this story of like animal testing and medical experiments, and its biggest failing is that the human characters make some like unbelievably boneheaded decisions throughout that ultimately lead to the downfall of humanity.
Yeah, I mean, that's... And I think the biggest problem with the movie is that James Franco is really miscast. No,
very miscast.
And I think...
And he is surrounded by infinitely better actors, too.
Exactly.
Because he's opposite, like, Frida Pinto, John Lithgow, Brian Cox, Tom Felton, you know, David Oyelowo. Like, it's just a wall-to-wall good cast, and it's all hinging on him, and he... He lacks the gravitas you need. He's more Mark Wahlberg than Charlton Heston.
Well, and part of the problem is it's very clear that he does not give a shit about that movie.
Yeah.
And he seems bored sort of through the whole thing. And I think a better actor or someone more committed could have sort of sold a lot of the more boneheaded choices as emotional choices.
Chris Pine. Put Chris Pine up. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, but I think the choices that he makes is just like, well, you seem like you're a dum-dum, but it's just because he doesn't care.
Well, 2011 was like the beginning of the end for like us taking Franco seriously, because that was around when didn't he host the Oscars around then? And just completely sandbag poor Anne Hathaway, who was there to do her job and he could not give a shit.
Yeah.
Fucking disaster artist. So, telling you, man, wasted opportunity.
I actually think he's pretty good in that,
he just looks like James Franco to me. He looks like he's playing Tommy Wiseau in an SNL sketch. I can't buy it. I'm sorry, you know? That's another movie also where everyone else is
just leagues and bounds better than him.
And he's like playing a cartoon character, which Tommy Wiseau kind of is, but I've not to beat a dead horse, but Daniel Day-Lewis, they should have tried.
Agreed.
Yeah. But yeah, so Rise of the Planet of the Apes was a surprise box office and critical hit, and of course it then yielded two sequels, the first of which was Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which should have been the first title, because you rise after dawn, but we won't quibble. This movie lost the Best Visual Effects Oscar, by the way.
Which one, War or
Rise?
Or Dawn?
Rise did.
What did it lose it to?
Hugo.
Okay, yeah. I guess. I don't know.
It's give Andy Serkis an Oscar.
Yeah, seriously.
Every single one of these has lost the Best Visual Effects Oscar.
Let's see, what was Dawn?
Interstellar.
Okay. And then what was for War?
Blade Runner 2049.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, I mean...
No, whatever. Whatever. It's pretty, but it's like, you know, It's just doing what they did in the 80s.
Just bigger.
Oh, I like Blade Runner 2049, actually. And I'm not like a Blade Runner worshiper, so I'm probably the right person for it. But no, so then there's Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. So the end of Rise is that the virus, or the cure for Alzheimer's that James Franco is engineering that makes apes intelligent also gives humans like some sort of horrible flu and kills them. And right. The end of the movie and the beginning of Dawn are a global pandemic that wipes out civilization, essentially.
Which is, when you're rewatching these movies, that aspect of the second one and a little bit of this one is it's a little too close to home.
That opening credits of Dawn, where it's spreading across the globe, is actually like the scariest thing in the entire franchise.
Absolutely.
It really sets the tone for the movie well, because that one's the apocalypse one that involves the eight. It's a remake of the first movie is like a reboot of Conquest, and then the second two are like the best possible reboots of Battle that you could possibly make.
And because they just basically just take away the mutants and it's just humans versus apes is kind of what the conflict is.
Yeah, exactly. And the apes, the ape, inter-ape conflict. Ape must not kill ape. And that's kind of a runner through both Dawn and War for Caesar, is that he's, you know, fearing that he's becoming like Koba, who was was more abused by humans and more vindictive and ultimately started the war between the apes and the humans, betraying Caesar. The second movie is like right out of the gate. You're like, okay, this is a way more confident movie. This movie is like, we can focus on the apes. We can have entire sequences where they're communicating through subtitles and sign language. And we can really draw these characters and make them feel like real, distinct characters from each other without the benefit of, dialogue or costumes or anything. And it's such an achievement. It's so well done. And it just makes you kind of wish you didn't have to spend time with, like, Jason Clarke and Kerry Russell.
there is a lot sort of given over to human drama in that second movie, and you're kind of just like, all right, well, I guess we have to get through this so that we can get to Caesar. But I think once the two intersect, once the humans and apes sort of get together, once Jason Clarke is part and Caesar are together, I think the movie really clicks.
I think they all have a middle act that kind of drags, and then it really comes together for the third act. And they do too good a job with the apes that the humans feel kind of, kind of boring in comparison. Like you can really just like know who Caesar is as a character in a way that you can't tell that with Jason Clarke or James Franco, and less so with Woody Harrelson, but he's also a very arch villain in the third one.
Right.
But
yeah.
And it's like, I forget every time Gary Oldman's in that movie.
Right. Yeah. Actually sort of doing an understated Gary Oldman thing. He's not as like sort of like big as you think.
Well,
he would
the trailers
be.
Made him seem like he was going to be a big villain, and he's not really. He's a little like his character kind of, I feel like you only get like 75% of his arc.
Yeah. It's a movie. Dawn is a movie that feels like it's hacked down from a longer movie a little bit.
I'm going to venture a guess that these movies all were fighting waves of studio notes. We can't have a whole movie that's just apes doing sign language. And Matt Reeves was like, you want to go? I'll do it.
I'll do it.
I'm Matt Reeves. I make pretty genre movies.
Yes, Matt Reeves came in as the director for Dawn and War, and he's just, and like you say, he's just...
Gorgeous movies.
Yeah, he just brings just an unwavering confidence to what's happening now. And maybe the studio sort of got off their back or something a little bit. I don't know, but...
I think by the time they got to War, they got off their back because they were like, okay, these things are making money. People clearly are going back to see the apes, not the humans.
Yeah.
And I think they also, someone probably pointed out, that's the case with the entire franchise.
Right.
There is no continuity of humans across the first five movies. It's all, you're just going to see Roddy McDowall.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess Heston does show up in the second one, but he's the only reoccurring human character in any of these.
And Ricardo Montalban.
Oh, Ricardo Montalban, of course. Yeah.
Ricardo Montalban.
I can't forget him.
You can't forget. He will not let you forget him. But yeah, and so then the final movie comes out in 2017, and like all good Planet of the Apes movies, it is dark.
Really dark.
These all end on like a hopeful yet down note. Like, it's like, you know, oh, the apes made it, and Caesar is leading his people to, you know, leading, he's gonna help them survive, but things are gonna get way worse first.
Yeah, everything's gonna be bad, really bad. Yeah, I mean, and like right off the bat when this movie starts, like the special effects are just leaps and bounds better than what they were in 2011. Like, I mean, like just the way the apes move and their fur moves, like at a certain point you forget you're watching special effects at all.
No, it's so well done. It's just like, it's not showy. They're just apes, and they move like apes, and they interact like apes. They're not superhuman. They're just, well, I mean, chimps are fucking terrifying anyway, but like, you know, you get these distinct characters and the physicality of all the different species. You have orangutans, you have gorillas, you have chimps. They're not moving like humans.
Right.
And they all are like capable of different things.
Yeah. And the thing, especially with Caesar, because you're spending the most time with him, is like his eyes are so expressive.
Yeah. And that's kind of like the turn in the first movie that like once he has his eyes have like a change.
Yeah.
Where he stops being an animal. He stops being sort of innocent, and he becomes, you know, smart. He becomes more human.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, it's very striking. And the way that this movie sort of opens as sort of like this extended, you know, Vietnam Apocalypse Now riff it's staggering sort of in its filmmaking. And a lot of the stuff that he does, that Reeves does here, he sort of pulls again in the Batman, you know, like when they're running down the cave, and then all you see is sort of the muzzle flashes illuminating
I noticed that's a, like, he definitely was like playing with that idea. He likes the visual of like flashes of light in tunnels,
because
you see elements of that in Cloverfield as well.
Oh, yeah, that's
when they're
right.
in the subway. Like he likes just, you know, only giving you a glimpse of what's happening, but you still can,
like, you can, you know, still track it, but it doesn't feel sort of seizure inducing.
To talk about the Batman for a moment, it's a very stylized movie. It's beautifully shot, but there are sequences in that where you'd, like the car chase with the penguin, where you'd think you couldn't tell what was going on and you couldn't make out the geography of it, but you watch it and it all cuts together, and you know, it's like, it's all shot like low angles, point of view shots all through the rain, all with like strobing like headlights, but you still can pinpoint where everything is. And that is such an accomplishment. He really knows how to cut like an action sequence together.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and this one has a lot more action scenes than Dawn did. I feel like, I mean, there's a lot more sort of, I mean, there's more, Dawn had like sort of that big battle scene at the end.
It's almost too big.
Yeah, I think
it's,
so.
It's
too.
A little. It was a little Marvel. You know, the big collapsing tower.
Yeah, where they're fighting on the collapsing tower, and it's just,
It's very Revenge of the Sith.
Yeah, but yeah, like you say, it looks so stunning, and it is so bleak. And
yeah, it's so bleak, but it's bleak. It's bleak in a way where you're still invested in it. It's not like, you're not watching The Road.
No,
where it's
just
like, oh God, get me out of this world. It's like, oh, you're still like, you are so invested in these apes, and you're not feeling conflicted. Like, there's, I think the thing, this movie, that the confidence they have in the apes, they also feel like, we don't have to have the humans have any moral quandary anymore.
Exactly.
Like, none of them, even like the preacher, the guy, the crossbow guy, you'd think might have like an arc where he is conflicted, but he's not. He's still like loyal to Woody Harrelson. That arc is given to
One of the apes.
The gorilla. Yeah.
No, and actually I had forgotten completely about that. And as I was watching it, I was like, oh yeah, this guy's going to have like the turn where he like becomes, you know, sympathetic to the apes, because that's what it's leading you to. And it does this thing where it completely zags, where you think it's going to zig and you're like, what the fuck? And it was great. It was just such a well-constructed, like, flip on expectations.
Yeah, I'd forgotten how big a role Red the gorilla has in the movie, and he is kind of like, he is the counterpart to Caesar in this.
And it's interesting to sort of look at the way that Caesar is so concerned initially that, you know, he's going to become Koba, that like he's going to be consumed by vengeance like Koba, and it's going to like eat him alive. And then it nearly does, because, you know, the general comes and kills his family and everything, and he's like just ready to like kill every human he sees.
Well, the movie, always the main studio note is, we can't give Judy Greer too much to do. It's not allowed. That's how Judy Greer has now died twice in threequels on our show. It's not
Judy
right.
Greer.
We love Judy Greer.
We do love Judy Greer. Yeah.
It's got a middle act thing where it just moves a little too slow in like the time between when Woody Harrelson and when the colonel and the troops kill his family to when they're back at the base.
Yeah.
It's just stretched out a little too long, but that third act again just really hums along, and it's like this awesome prison break movie.
Yeah, no, it's cool, and it's cool that it doesn't what you expect. It's another thing where it reverses your expectations, where you sort of think that it's headed towards this big battle and a big war, but it actually isn't. It's just the apes trying to escape and survive. They don't really, like, fight back, per se. They're just trying to get out of there.
No, they have no investment in the humans on either side. And the movie literally is like, these humans don't matter anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Literally, we're going to just avalanche them all out of the way.
This is the planet of the apes now. Get with the program, yeah.
Yes. Have you not read the title? No, like, actually, the more I think about it, along the way, they do just have this nice build, though, of introducing these new characters as you go. So you introduce Nova, and you introduce, you have the resolution with Winter, the white ape who betrays, the white gorilla who betrays them, and you have the setting up what's happening to humans that sort of tease up that they're going to become feral in over time. And then you introduce Bad Ape.
Right.
And that's like basically that there's another universe where Bad Ape comes in and just Jar Jars the whole show. But that character works so well.
Yeah. I mean, and it's Steve Zahn plays Bad Ape. I mean, and he's a gift to any movie he's in, but he's a real gift. He's a real gift here.
Of Jesse Plemons' 12 roles he
plays
every year.
Yeah.
Nothing. I love Jesse Plemons, but just give two of them to Steve Zahn.
Yeah.
He should be in more stuff.
He's
so good.
He really should, and he's so good in this movie. He brings like an energy that this movie really needs, because otherwise it could get real bleak. Because Caesar's in such a dark place.
He's at such a dark place. He's the only ape that like talks all the time. He can fully talk, and then so you introduce this new character that is a little lighter and he's a little funnier, but, you know, still is like this character that's had horrible trauma and lost his family and he's all alone. And, you know, he ultimately agrees to help them. And he just adds like a really nice dynamic to the group.
Yeah.
Because you have like, basically there's three main hero apes, because you've got Caesar and you've got Maurice, who's the orangutan, who's sort of the wise one. He's the smart one.
Yeah.
And he's the like sort of stabilizing force on like the angel on Caesar's shoulder. And he's sort of paired with Nova. And then you have Bad Ape as sort of a counterpart to them. So they're kind of running this little escape. And then you have Rocket, of course.
Yes.
Yeah, Terry Notary. Rocket, the Wedge Antilles of this franchise.
Well, and especially because in that Rise of the Planet of the Apes, you think Rocket's going to be like this antagonist. And he doesn't. He makes it through the whole thing. He's great.
No, yeah. And he's, I'd forgotten. They reference it in this one. I'd forgotten like his son gets killed by Koba, and he's just like that quintessential like ride or die.
Yeah, he's like, I'm with you to the very end.
Well, it's like you have that great sequence where he has to, like, run into the base and distract all the soldiers to make sure that Nova and Caesar don't get caught. And I genuinely thought, like, oh, they're going to kill him.
Yeah,
he's
going to die. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I mean, it's like all the flaws of the movie, thinking back on it, I just paste over. I skip right over them. They don't faze me. In hindsight, I watched this... I started watching it at home in like 15-minute chunks, and I got like halfway through it, and you know, I was like, it's good, but I wish I could watch it. And then we went to Philadelphia a couple weeks ago, and it was on the airplane. So I watched it on the flight to Philly while Cece was asleep, and I was like, oh, this movie's so good.
Yeah.
And it has to be seen straight through, because it is just such an accomplishment. It is crazy that these movies are so well done. Yeah. They're not perfect by any means, but like, I would argue that this is one of the best trilogies of films that's come out.
No, I think so.
Certainly in recent memory.
No, I mean, and I think that these are three of some of the best science fiction movies of the 2010s. I think it's kind of, they're underrated in a way, I think. I mean, it's one of those things where everyone liked them, but they're...
I think there's just something about Planet of the Apes where people dismiss it offhand because the original is so baked into... Everyone thinks of, you know, oh my God, I was wrong. You know, they all think of that.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, you go back and you realize, oh shit, these are really smart scripts going back to the original. Like the first four of those movies are really, you know, well-written, well-directed, well-acted movies. The fifth one's... It's not like a blight on the franchise. The remake, the Tim Burton version, is an interesting failure.
Right.
And then these new ones just are so confident in themselves as they go, but while still feeling like they're respectful of the franchise. Like the fans, I don't think there's any, I don't know any purist Apes fans.
No, I don't.
Yeah. I don't know any purist Apes fans at all, but I don't know any purist Apes fans that dislike the new ones. They all like them. They all feel like this is respectful. You don't have this. I mean, I'm sure it exists if I went deep enough on Reddit, but you don't have, like, a Star Wars divide where there's, like, old Star Wars fans and Disney Star Wars fans and they all fucking hate each other. This is a universe where everyone likes every single one of the movies except we all agree Battle looks like shit and Tim Burton's one isn't very good.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, but I think also it's not, I think... Part of it, even though it is a franchise that in some level does appeal to kids, it's not a franchise that's, like, for kids, you know? I think Star Wars being partially designed for children, I think instills a lot of that more, like, passion. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's also that, you know, obviously the original movies had a lot of merchandising, but these ones aren't, like, there were no Caesar action figures for the new one. These were much more geared towards adults. They're not marketed as, like, fun summer blockbusters.
Yeah.
Like, the new one feels like it's kind of the lightest of the new ones.
Yeah, I mean...
You've seen it, I have
not. I have, and I don't want to spoil anything for you. It's not as good as the others. It's good. I'd say it's a solid movie. It does a lot of things where it's, like, it's trying to set up other movies, and I think that's what sort of kills it. Because what's nice about these three movies, though, is that none of them are setting up the next sequel.
Dawn
a little bit, but they really are telling a complete story.
Yeah, and they rarely address what happened in the prior movie.
Right.
Like, you assume James Franco died in the pandemic, and I think they had a deleted scene in War where they set up what happened to Jason Clarke. I think Woody Harrelson killed him.
Oh, okay.
But it's like, you don't need that.
No.
There's no, like, post credits in Dawn where Woody Harrelson shows up or anything like that. These, like the originals, it's like, okay, this is where it ends. Maybe we're going to get a sequel, but we'll write ourselves out of whatever corner we put ourselves in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's just, you know, it's just they don't have to go to such extreme lengths. It's like, uh-oh, we blew up the planet. What do we do?
No. They know better than that. But hey, that got you Escape, and that revitalized that franchise for another three movies.
Yeah,
you know,
so.
You wouldn't have Caesar without Escape from the Planet of the Apes.
That's true. So now here's a question for you, Sam. Do you think that these movies are on the timeline of the original Planet of the Apes, or do you think it's a separate thing? Let's nerd out on the ape stuff for a moment.
Okay. This is oh god. Well, I mean, we've tried to do this with Terminator before, so this can't be too hard.
There's really only one. Like, there's two timelines here, right?
Well, there's the original. The implication that by the end of battle, the timeline has been rewritten,
right?
Because you know, it's not necessarily that going back and having Caesar was a predestination paradox situation,
right.
Because their history that they tell in Escape, it's Aldo. I believe his name is.
Right.
Erno? Something
like
asshole.
That, yeah.
The Koba of Battle of the Planet of the Apes is the one that led the rebellion. Whereas in this, at the end of 5, at the end of battle, it's implied that humans and apes now coexist.
Right.
It's a little ambiguous, but that's the implication. So I'm going to say no. Well, because also... I'm going to say no. Because there's just enough differences. Like, the plague in the original killed all the dogs and the cats.
That's true.
Not the people.
Yeah.
It's like, but that's the nice thing. They take all these things that happened in the original timeline, and they just rework them
a little bit. Yeah.
They tweak it a little bit, and it's like, thankfully those movies are old enough, and not like, the nerds that like them are thoughtful enough that they don't get all bent out of shape.
Yeah. Well, and it's also, you could, if you were trying to like connect the timelines in sort of a no prize sort of way, you could say, oh, well, the history that the apes had was like fractured and wasn't completely complete. I don't know, if you wanted to. If
you could. So when are they going to all get Nehru jackets?
That's after, like, a thermonuclear skirmish, I guess.
Oh, so that's after... So in Kingdom, the post-credits is they find a whole case of Nehru jackets and, like, leather helmets.
Yep, exactly.
And a Flintstones set that they can all live on. Don't put this idea out into the universe, because you know it's just going to end up with a digitally de-aged Charlton Heston, you know.
Stumbling out of a spaceship. Of Planet of the Apes, this horrible AI homunculus.
Oh my god, I was wrong. It was Earth all along. No, his estate will say no, so it's a digitally de-aged James Francisco.
Listen, I just want these movies to have the nuclear bomb worshipping telepathic mutants. That's all I want.
we all want that. They're gonna get a 6-episode limited series on Max,
Disney
like the Penguin. Yeah.
On Disney Plus.
To our God.
I want to highlight Michael Giacchino's score here.
Oh, yes. As always,
but it is really good.
He's great. He just always... I mean, he's done most of Matt Reeves' stuff, because he did the Batman.
So, yeah.
And he did that one bit of music at the end of Cloverfield.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's great. His Star Trek scores are really good. He's done, like, a bunch of the Mission Impossible movies.
Yeah.
He's done all, like, Brad Bird stuff.
Yeah.
You know, he's just a really... His scores are so... They're very varied, but they have... He's like a John Williams. I think of him as the modern John Williams.
Yeah, a lot of the quarantine zones and stuff is hard to stomach.
Yeah, the little hints you get of the apocalypse. I haven't seen it, but there's also a deleted scene where at the very end when they're going to the Oasis,
mm-hmm.
they go through the ruins of Las Vegas.
Oh, that would be cool. But...
Yeah, well, that's... well. That's what Resident Evil 3.
Well, and also Godzilla, the Godzilla 2014 had like a ruined Las Vegas thing.
Oh yeah,
too.
Right, because the fucking trailers for Godzilla 2014 kept showing a close up of the Statue of Liberty all smashed,
right.
Like Cloverfield did. But then if you look at it, you're like, wait, that's the New York casino. You can't fool us.
Yeah,
there's no. Oh, I mean. I gotta say, when it comes to cinematic apes, though, the little ones are better. I can get behind them way more than Kong. I can't get invested in Kong the same way.
Yeah,
I've been trying.
I mean, it depends on the way Kong is done. Have you seen Godzilla X Kong?
Godzilla Hearts Kong?
Yeah.
I have not yet. I haven't seen anything, Will. I don't leave
no,
the condo.
You've got a...
I have a 17-month-old, and she will not let us leave. She's got a stick. she's very, very strong.
No, I totally understand. I will say that Godzilla X Kong, the new kingdom, or the new world, whatever it's called...
The new empire. is not to be confused with Ghostbusters Frozen Empire.
It's the most fun of all of these monster movies, MonsterVerse movies. So take that as you will. It's the silliest.
They've embraced the silly. It's just so funny because if you go back and watch Godzilla 2014, it's trying to be so grounded. So serious.
I mean, this one feels like an 80s cartoon. And I mean that like in the best way, but it is.
They got to embrace the Heisei era or the late Showa. Like, leave the serious shit to Toho. Godzilla is serious. Godzilla belongs to them.
Yeah. Also, the little girl who plays Nova is really good
too. Yeah, she's really good, and that's a tough. She's acting opposite all these guys in mocap. That's not easy to do, and she does a really good job. And she also doesn't get to talk. Yeah. So, you know, it's that was a really clever spin on Nova.
Yeah.
I thought was really well done. Every time they tee up something that's from the originals, it's done in such a subtle way that you really, like, you either don't notice it or you notice it and you're like, oh, I like that. Like, the way the virus is mutating and it's right. Like, oh, okay, so this is how it's going to bring everything full circle.
Exactly. Yeah, no, and that, all that stuff is really cool. And then, this one ends on a hopeful note of Caesar leading his people to freedom and...
But still, they got to bring it down because he dies.
Yeah, and then he dies.
No, you guys ain't getting away that easy. This is Planet of the Apes, motherfucker.
Happy ending in the Apes?
Not for everyone. Literally, the ending of the movie is you pull out as they're all turning around to realize Caesar is dead. So it's literally you're watching them suddenly have a real come down, like a real, like, just, it's just watching the bummer hit. It's so pure Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, it really is.
It's how many of these movies end just with watching a character realizing something horrible
or experiencing something horrible, is the case. Yeah, maybe
either dying or experiencing something horrible.
Oh,
and they're so much fun and they're so good. It's like,
So is this one of the better part threes we've covered on the show? I think it is.
We were talking before this, and we were going back and forth over if War or Dawn is better, but I think an argument can be made that this is the answer is yes, definitely one of the best part threes we've seen by a, you know, like, it's high up there.
Yeah.
But I would also say there is an argument to be made that this is a trilogy where the third one is the best one.
Yeah, I think I think I'm coming around on your point. I think earlier when we were talking about it, I was pretty hard up saying Dawn is better because I think it just moves a little cleaner. But I think
there's more the slow middle act in Dawn is at least more active characters, but it just kind of feels like it's running in place. Yeah. At least with this one, it's the tone. It's appropriate for the tone of what they're going for in the movie. And it's just also, like, just beautiful scenery.
Yeah, and I think the stuff with Woody Harrelson and talking about... We should also mention, Woody Harrelson's pretty good in this movie, too.
Yeah.
With
a character, the character doesn't have a lot going for him. He is just the villain.
Right.
But it's Woody Harrelson is, like, really... He's the scenery chewer of the movie. But even then, he's pretty, like... chill. He's like a low-key scenery chewing.
Well, and I like that he's sort of like this low-key bad guy. Like
he's doing his Colonel Kurtz.
Yeah, exactly. Know? And I like all of that, and I really love the final scene with Caesar and him, you know, where Caesar's got the gun trained on him, and then you realize that, oh my god, he has the virus now, and he's becoming an animal. And I just, the way that whole thing is played and directed is so good.
And it's also just the whole build up to that moment is all the other soldiers like, where the fuck is the colonel? Where is he? Yeah. He won't come down.
So I think I'm coming around on your point, Sam. I think this is might be the best of the three.
I mean, you could make arguments for all three of the movies being the strongest one. I think there isn't. It's inarguable that an argument can be made for the third one being the best. Like, I'm sure there are people out there. I mean, there are people out there that like Return of the Jedi the best. There are people out there that like Return of the King the best. There are weirdos out there that like Godfather 3 the best. But, you know, this one is just a franchise that got more and more confident, and the studio got more and more confident in it as it went. Yeah. And it's not trying to be some huge shared universe. It's not trying to like, it's not trying to be like a prequel to the originals where it's got a tie back to the one from 1968. Right. It's its own thing. And obviously, because there's a fourth standalone movie now, that like it's set up enough to set up future movies, but they're set way in the future and they're their own thing too. I just think it's you don't see this very often with Hollywood franchises anymore.
No, you really don't. And it is, especially at that time when, you know, Marvel was sort of on its ascendancy, and you could have easily seen this turn into just sort of another generic sci-fi action blockbuster, and it, you know, it didn't. So
I think there is just not quite enough faith in the IP at Disney/Fox. It's like they're just like, they think it's just a little too goofy.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, every time they want to cut Planet of the out, because they're just like, it's so silly. There's the something of the Planet of the Apes. It's too long. It's too long. We can't fit that on the Netflix screen, you know. Genesis Apes. Whatever the fuck that means.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, and I think it's a franchise that you can probably, it's evergreen enough that it generates enough money, but it doesn't generate so much money that people are like really looking over your shoulder when you're making one of these things.
So I think they're just kind of like, okay, we can keep this going. It's a thing. There's enough of it. And clearly they make enough money. Like, this is the thing that bugs me, is that the takeaway from these movies' success shouldn't be we want more rebooted sci-fi franchises from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. It's, we just want something that's good and thoughtful. And if it happens to be IP, great, but it doesn't have to be.
Right.
You know? Like, yeah, you can make three movies, you can make a trilogy, but it doesn't have to be, like, a fucking remake of The Black Hole or Tron or something like that. Yeah. No one wants the... Oh, we're going to have to talk about the third Tron when it comes out.
Tron Ares. Yes. Ugh. Yes, we will.
Fucking Jared Leto. God damn it.
It's one of those... Tron is one of those movies where it's like, there has to be some executive who has managed to survive so many regime changes at Disney. And it's like, he's like, I am going to make Tron happen. That is my thing.
They did. It made a really good animated series.
But it's so funny. It's like, oh, we're going to try and bring Tron back. It's like, it didn't work the last time, guys. Why are we doing this?
Just make an open world MMORPG of
Call
Tron.
Call it a day. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, Jesus. We're going to keep trying. You know what? Fine, whatever. Why am I complaining about Tron? Tron never did anything to me. It's, you know, I've got so many other part threes I got to worry about. We're going to have to do Venom 3. Venom part. My God. What is that? I'm actually bummed that Michelle Williams isn't in this one, because she's actually my favorite. My favorite part of the first two is that every time she gets the symbiote, you can tell she's like really into it afterwards. Yeah. And she's like, I could wear it again. I'll do it. I'll do it.
I watched the second Venom, I think, partly through a head cold, so a lot of it sort of like didn't really register, but I did.
Speaking
like,
of Woody Harrelson.
Yeah, in a
But did you know Woody Harrelson was a teenager in the 90s?
That's right. Oh god. The first Venom movie is stupid fun. It is not good, but it is stupid fun.
Look, these Sony standalone Marvel Spider-Man adjacent movies are just I applaud their confidence to keep going. It's something about power and responsibility, and I don't want either when it comes to Spider-Man.
Not in this day and age.
No, and I don't need to make an Apes movie because they're doing such a great job.
That's so right.
It's like, it's the one franchise I never have to worry about.
Yeah.
Well, I guess this is my pick.
I think it is now, your pick.
And I'm going to throw you a curveball that I just thought of. We're going to swerve a little bit from what we've talked about before. We're going to drift, dare I say.
Oh, fun.
Because I don't got a podcast. I got a family. Because we're going to talk about the Fast and the Furious.
Hell
Tokyo
yeah.
Tokyo Drift, which he is technically in.
He is, yeah. Hell yeah.
We're talking about the Season of the Witch of the franchise.
That's awesome. I haven't seen it all the way through, but the summer that I was a projectionist at a movie theater, at the Dollar Theater, it played, and I watched bits and pieces of it here and there, and I always thought it looked like fun. So
I've heard it's actually, I've seen chunks of it. We watched different chunks of it when I worked on Turbo, the greatest racing snail TV show ever made. And I'm not saying that ironically, I love Turbo, but we watched a bunch of it, and it's like the CW one. It's before, it's what it is it's before the franchise became what it is now, but it's also the movie that brought a lot of the behind the scenes people,
creative guys,
that led to Fast Five and Furious Six and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Did you see the latest one? Did you see Fast X or whatever it's called?
No, I watched Nine.
Nine, they go to space.
Yeah, I saw that. I watched that one on HBO, so I haven't seen the latest one.
The latest one is nuts. Jason Momoa is insane in this movie.
It's like Jason Momoa doing Jack Sparrow, right? That's kind of...
It's Jason Momoa doing Jack Sparrow if Jack Sparrow was the Joker. Like, there is a scene in the movie where he's painting someone's toenails. I will say no more. You can watch it in conjunction with Tokyo Drift if you want, but you will know what I'm talking about when I say he's like the Jack Sparrow Joker.
Yeah, and we can talk about the loopy-ass timeline that these movies
That's
have.
That's true, yes, because Tokyo Drift is a sequel. It's technically like seventh in the franchise.
It takes place like right, but isn't it like all take place after seven or something
it's
like that?
It's in the post-credits of six,
right,
I
that's
believe.
Right, yeah.
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 No, I figured I've been listening to this podcast called For Your Amusement, where they review theme park rides, and we were just listening to the one about Fast and the Furious Supercharged, which is one of the most universally hated theme park rides, apparently, and that just got me thinking. I was like, okay, let's do this.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah,
I'm totally down.
Speaking of 10 installment long running franchises that are incredibly consistent.
Yep. Yeah. And so many of those movies sort of, except for like the major ones, I think 5, 6, and 7 sort of stick in my mind, but everything else just sort of goes in one ear and out the other.
I would say 5 and 6 are the high point. Yeah. 5 is like a legitimately great action movie, and 6 is a lot of fun. And after that, it just kind of goes off the rails.
Yeah.
That's when they start realizing, that's when you realize, okay, no one actually stays dead in these movies.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I think a lot of that is because of like the grief that Paul Walker's death sort of put over everything. I think there's a lot of this feeling like, I gotta bring everyone back to life.
I think it's that, and I think it's also actors go away for other franchises, and those franchises end, and they've got nothing to do.
Yeah, no, I think that's part of it.
Yeah, because the one character where it would narratively make sense that he's no longer alive is canonically still alive. But in the movies, they all talk about him
like he's dead.
And it's so weird. Like, in the last one, like, Vin Diesel's in his garage, and he's got all these pictures up of, like, him and Brian, Paul Walker's character. And then they're, like, that song, like, When I See You Again, starts playing in the background. And I'm like, you could just call him. His wife and kid were just over for dinner.
Yeah, or when he shows, he's like showing up to the barbecue, and it's just like the back of somebody's. What are we doing here?
It's the modern version of. You remember that short film, The Death of Xander Cage, that was on the XXX State of the Union DVD, where it just shows like some bald dude in the back of his head, and then he gets blown up, and then like the skin with the tattoo on it like lands on the ground, and that's supposed to confirm that Xander Cage is dead.
Right. Yes.
Oh, well, after we do Tokyo Drift, that will be the elephant in the room. We've got a couple other Vin Diesel threequels we got to get to.
Yeah, well,
and we can think about what's going to be harder to watch.
Well, we can hold off on Riddick at least until that new one eventually slimes its way into theaters.
God. That third one, man.
I think it has things to recommend it, but it is very clearly a vanity project, that third Riddick movie.
I think the thing I would recommend from it is don't write off Dave Bautista for this movie alone.
Fair enough. Yeah, cool. So we'll be joining Fast and the Furious friends in Japan, or at least, actually, no, none of the main characters are in that. It's all new characters.
No, Han is introduced, and he becomes a recurring character. And the other guys, like, show up for, like, small parts in later movies. But, no, this is as standalone, Hobbs and Shaw aside, this is as standalone as a Fast and Furious movie can get.
Right, and it brings on Justin Lin as the director, and, this'll be fun.
Yeah, be fun. Yeah, but until then, War for the Planet of the Apes, our highest marks for a threequel. So goddamn good.
So good.
You haven't seen these movies or the originals, check them out. It is like, if you want like something that's fun, a little campy, but also like very earnest and very well done and very well written, just blaze through the whole series. Watch the Tim Burton one even. It's so dumb, you know. It's so dumb and it's weirdly horny. Like Helena Bonham Carter is like way into Mark Wahlberg in that movie, and she's a chimp. You know? See it for Paul Giamatti. Yeah. I can't stress that enough. You know,
and just the wild production design and the makeup. I mean, there's stuff to recommend. It's not a good movie, and
it's got some really good practical work in it. It's like it's a movie. It's the last time that stuff would have been done practical because it's CG in the new ones, and that's not a bad thing. That's what needed to be done to evolve the characters. But you know, it's an oddity. It's a very interesting little oddity in the franchise.
Yeah.
I can't say don't see it and then tell people go see Season of the Witch if you like the Halloween movies, because the anomalies are the most interesting ones sometimes.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Jaws 3.
Jaws 3.
Jaws 3 is actually quite in keeping with the Jaws franchise.
It is not an anomaly at all.
No. Well, it is in that it looks the worst.
In that it is very... Yeah, it is very cheap.
Jaws 3. Oh, I think about that episode all the time, because that was just like, oh, that movie was so dumb, and I couldn't help but, like, I was just like, I was charmed by how dumb it was.
Yeah, it is. So much just footage of people wandering around SeaWorld.
and not making SeaWorld look good. But this is the thing. I like those kind of movies, because as I've said many times, not all of us are going to get to make Jaws. But we might get to make Jaws 3. So it's on us to make sure we know how to make the best Jaws 3 we can.
It's a very good point. That's a very good point, Sam.
You can learn as much from trash as you can from high art.
Absolutely.
And on the subject of both, we will see you all next time for the Fast and the Furious Tokyo Drift. Will, always a delight, always a pleasure. This movie was great.
Yes.
This was a winner. You did good.
Yeah, I guess so. I have my moments where I pick good ones. They're few and far between, but it does happen.
It happens to be that both Apes threequels are really good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It just works out that way.
Yeah. But we'll see how Fast and the Furious handles their threequel next time. And until then, folks, I hope you're all doing well. Stay cool or stay warm wherever you are, and we will see you next time.
Apes together strong.
Apes together strong. Fight like apes!